Don't Make an Ideology, a podcast about the 69th best show of television in the 21st century, according to the BBC and whoever they asked. I'm one of your hosts, Ian, and here, as always, with...
Ryan Swen. Hello again.
Hi, Ryan.
It's strange. Like, it's... I think that there's a certain, not a hang-up necessarily, but like a certain like strangeness still to the endeavor, just the endeavor of this specific sort of show and this specific sort of set of concerns. We're covering we didn't actually say the hours last time. I think that's important. So I think that we're covering the hours from 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. In the first season of 24.
And like 24, the show occurs in real time.
Not really, we're editing also.
No, you're not supposed to tell them that. It's part of the conceit.
Part of the conceit. I will say that the conceit, I feel like it's already, I don't know, breaking down to a certain extent. Like, there's a certain, at the end of the 2 to 3, there's this moment where it shows the clock when Jack is confronting Nina in the office and like the crow's nest at CPU.
Yes,
with Jamie.
Yeah.
And it shows 2:56, and then a good like 4 or 5 minutes later it shows the clock again and it's 2:57:29.
Dang, you're on that.
Well, I just noticed it because I just noticed that there was a pop-up and then another pop-up so soon after, and
I should start making better reference to that. I was mostly keeping an eye out for if Jack Bauer ate any food, which he did not. He hasn't eaten for a little while now.
I didn't really expect that to be... I mean, the joke always with 24 was, when do they go to the restroom?
Oh, well, I'm also looking out for that, yeah.
Oh,
but if you're not eating, you know, then you're... if you're not eating or drinking anything, then I suppose, you know, you're kind of putting off the rest of it.
That's true. We didn't emphasize before in the first episode that there's the show, obviously our starting hour changes throughout the seasons, but with this starting at 12, it's just like at this perfect sort of sweet spot of being tired, but not too tired, and then just getting more and more tired throughout the day.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't really comprehend before just like how awful it must be to be on what, already be awake for around 18 hours or so, 16, 18 hours, and then having to go for another 24.
Yeah, I mean, Jack Bauer seems like a up at 5 a.m. kind of guy, you know, so he's creeping up on, he's been up for a full 24 already. This actually, it's interesting that you bring this up, because one thing I was thinking about while watching these episodes is like, what if you did this same thing for like just the day before all the bad stuff happens, like the same real time, like everybody was just going about their day, having just like a normal boring day at the office. You know, Jack is like in the doghouse at home, but trying to bring the family back together. Maybe they like ordered Chinese in for dinner or something, you know, and then the whole season closes with like him and Kim sitting down to start a game of chess. And then that's what the prequel is. That's the prequel pitch, is just the day before.
I thought that you were going to say something just like sort of just like a normal day in general, but you mean the day literally before day one. I mean, like, that makes it like considerably more interesting, just because it's so ludicrous, just like the idea of very, very highly scripted sort of thing where like, oh, it's going to be the primary tomorrow. Who are you going to vote for? Stuff like that. It's just like all these things interspersed in between. And like, there's other, something we didn't know is that apparently, I think Jamie's coming from a party or something like that, or like a club or a rave.
Yeah, because in that first set, because they all get called in, you know, all hands on deck, and it's like, what were they all doing? What were they all doing right before then?
I think there's a quote from Jamie, like an exchange between Jamie and Nina that goes, Jamie, how long is this going to take? Nina, why? Are we interrupting your social life? Jamie, at least I have one.
Oh, burn. I forgot about that. That's a great line. It's, you know, something I do notice is that I really feel like in these two most recent episodes, the characters are beginning to like have more personality and chemistry. I really felt like that was just not the case, particularly in the pilot. It did seem like, you know, everybody showed up to set that day and hadn't met. And these most recent episodes, you know, you're starting to get a little bit of a sense. Different actors are kind of given their moments to kind of do their thing, which is nice.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I think it still feels strange, largely because something that I didn't realize until I was like looking further into it, and obviously we're going to be talking about the entire season, so I think it's like one of the things that we do remember is that Nina is a mole, like a significant mole. Like, and apparently that wasn't actually, the writers didn't actually write it in a script until like the last 5 episodes or something like that.
Oh wow.
They just like had like, so at this point certainly Sarah Clark is playing Nina just like as a, you know, dedicated Jack flunky, as George Mason calls her.
Yeah.
Like, so like there's, I think that was something that we don't really have, we aren't really privy to aside from when they talk about these things in interviews and such, that they're, that the characters, that the actors frequently aren't aware of like just how much this develops and how many sort of twists and turns they're putting in. So I think that like that's what makes this last, like the sort of ending of episode 3 and like this sort of ongoing tension because Jack thinks that she's a mole, like in, like even more strangely interesting.
Yeah, like, I have to give props to the writers on that one, because I do think that the show, as ridiculous as it is, like one of its key components is just constantly throwing out these red herrings, mm-hmm. That, you know, make you think that X thing will be really important all season, right? You know, and then not just like revealing that the opposite is true, but going off in an entirely different direction. But I had totally forgotten that, you know, by episode 3, it's like, oh, Nina is the mole. but it like works through that conflict once, so that in the viewer's mind, at least, like that's a settled matter. Right. And if I recall correctly, like Tony ends up kind of being set up as the guy, right? Because him and Jack like have this antagonism.
He's already immediately like, it's just like it's just him calling in the end, like saying that Jack Bauer has lost control to CTU. It's just like this, CTU is locked down within the first 4 hours of this show.
It seems so easy too. Just one guy making a call, just like shut it down. Which begs the question too, which I think is how I ended up on my, you know, a day in the normal life of Jack Bauer. But like, it seems like in the early, like very first hours of the show, we don't really at first have a sense of like Jack's total like sicko mode intensity. and that gets revealed, you know, fairly quickly. And by this point in the show, it's like well established, but it's like, you know, has he always been this kind of loose cannon? Like going, like, is this just another in a series of like Jack Bauer going off? Because it seems a little bit at odds with him like turning in, you know, the dirty agents or whatever. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, I think that there is a, he's a certain kind of like archetypal hero that's both like, you know, the rules are for everybody except me, you know, like that's what he is. That's like a very, I think like a very classic type, right? In that he would be the, you know, rigid enforcer on everybody else, but then when it comes to him, you know, he's the glorious exception, right?
Right. I mean, like, there's this, like, it's certainly going for something like a Dirty Harry sort of thing, but it's also more clear that he's very clearly principled. Like, it's trying to make it
nice.
But then, like, you also get him literally saying to the police officer, the cops have to play by the rules. Well, whether that's true or not, it's up for debate.
We need to talk about the cops.
There's so much cop stuff in these two episodes, which I think
so
was really
conflicting
fascinating.
Too.
Yeah, it's like fascinating, but also like, you know, bad and all that, but like, and then he says we're gonna have to break a few to catch this guy, who's played by John Hawks. And
yes, I that was my last note was John Hawks, 2 question marks.
Yeah, like I saw him in the opening credits, but he's like very like even more slimmed or like, you know, like I didn't recognize him when I saw him.
Yeah, well, and he looks like younger too. I think of him as being a little, you know, he looks a little more grizzled now, a little more
even
dignified, less weedy.
Yeah, even in Miami Vice, he looked like John Hawks, and that was like 5 years later. So.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Does that mean Miami Vice is part of the 24 Hours Don't Make an Ideology extended universe?
I mean, yes. We definitely can talk. I mean, like, there's a lot of, you know, Iraq War. Like Miami Vice is very much, if he made an Iraq War film, like I think like there's something about like the sort of reportage and like documentary style to it that I think is plugged into that and into that sort of idea or that sort of era, but
yeah,
we can talk about that later.
Yeah, that would be a bonus episode. We'll keep that in mind, put that in the bank.
Yeah, definitely many bonus episodes. Going back to the sicko mode thing, we didn't really mention it in the last few episodes, but like just how quickly violent it gets, the show, like there's both the thumb that Jack Bauer cuts off, and there's also Janet just getting her arms broken.
Oh yeah,
have to deal it with for the next hour.
This is like, I don't remember if I mentioned actually on the last episode or just in talking with you, but I've been watching The Sopranos for the first time, and I'm almost done as we've started the show here. But, you know, and obviously that show has a reputation for being extremely violent, you know, on HBO, sure, et cetera. But in some ways, 24's brutality is just as visceral. And I'm a little bit surprised at how just kind of gory it is, and kind of how, and I wonder too if it's just like the film grain and stuff. Like it looks like that first scene when he's got that thumb in episode 3 and he's just like drenched in sweat and he just already looks like shit, and he's just holding this like grizzled bloody thumb and like puts it on the little keypad thing in the SUV. I was like, dang, I can't believe this was like airing at like 9 o'clock on Mondays.
Yeah, I didn't like realize just how sweaty he was. Like, I didn't remember how sweaty he was just in that car.
Yeah,
and of course he changes. Just one of the great perks of having the crow's nest that like the director's office is having that closet, that little closet that he can just put.
He's
gone in like a change of clothes.
Yeah, we get to see Kiefer's tats. He takes his shirt off. I feel like that's gonna happen a lot in this show if memory serves.
The quick changes.
Yeah. You know, this is what happens when you bag like a movie actor for your lead, though.
Yeah.
You can have them take their shirt off all the time.
I hadn't quite thought of it in those terms. I mean, do you mean like it's just like you don't see TV actors doing that much, or?
I think it's just, I want to say it's in kind of the gestures and the body language of the primarily film actor that I think that TV is a lot more about acting with your face.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that, I think Bergman said something like that about directing for TV. He liked directing for TV because it's all about the close-up, right? But I think for film, I think it requires an actor to have, and not all actors do, of course, but I think that like the ones that I find more interesting have a sense of their bodies in the frame. And, you know, I think that to some degree, like Kiefer Sutherland is bringing that to the show. I mean, compare him to what's the fake Jack Bauer, Alan.
Alan York.
Yeah, which it feels like, you know, it almost feels like they created that character specifically to punish this guy for not getting the role of Jack Bauer. He gets all pissed at the cop and then just like immediately gets owned, right? Like it really feels like they're punishing him for not being Jack Bauer. Yeah. But yeah, like he kind of lumbers around a little bit.
Yeah.
And you know, no offense to that actor, who I'm sure has done all kinds of great work, but it's like so apparent that this show works in large part because of Kiefer Sutherland's presence.
Yeah, there's a great physicality just like to the way he runs and like the way he's just like, especially through that warehouse chase in the fourth episode. Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
But like before we stray too far from Kiefer, something that I didn't realize, but I think we have to know, which is very bizarre, is that Kiefer Sutherland, Terry Hope, Alicia Cuthbert, all Canadians.
Oh, they're all Canadians?
Yeah. The first family of 24 is all of American show is all Canadian.
That's just going to change how I watch the whole rest of the show.
Yeah.
Man, are any of them Quebecois?
Oh, I don't know about that. Okay. Assume not, but...
We'll have to do some digging. We'll have to get the research team on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, all Canadians. Maybe that's like the TV version of having Brits play Americans all the time.
Oh, wow. I mean, yeah, like there's I mean, obviously there's shows that are... like primarily shot in Canada, like Battlestar Galactica or things like that. Like that have become like big hits in the US, but it's, yeah, I don't know. Like that's something to look into. I can't really think of many other like really notable Canadian actors, but.
Well, it's cause they're secret. Like they're stealthy. They're sliding in. You don't notice them. That's what they're, you know, they're like spies in that way, which is maybe appropriate for why they cast Kiefer Sutherland. Maybe we mentioned this already, but they cast him basically because he was friends with Stephen Hopkins, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like just like he was good friends, so he like suggested him, and they wanted a bigger star, so they just went with him.
Yeah,
entirely to the show's benefit, but it's
absolutely, yeah. Canadians. What are you going to do?
I don't think there's that many Canadian subplots in 24, unfortunately. I have no doubt we'll continue to note this trend, but...
Yeah, we'll have to keep a Canada watch going. And also, you know, one thing I'm thinking of is they did originally intend to shoot the show in Toronto, I think.
Oh, right, yeah, that's
so
true.
Maybe there was kind of a draw there initially for some of... Mm-hmm. Although I can't imagine... I assume Kiefer Sutherland lives in L.A.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, from
the interior of his Cooking with Kiefer videos, that looks like a very L.A. kitchen to me.
I was going to bring up the Bloor Street stuff, but you dug even deeper.
His website is great. He's a Renaissance man. He does everything. You got to respect it. And when your father is Donald Sutherland, I feel like there's a lot of pressure to do something better than him. And to my knowledge, Donald Sutherland has not released like any new country kind of albums. Which are apparently really popular in the UK. I think his last album
Keepers?
Charted. Yeah, his last album charted like number 2 on the UK country charts or something crazy like that. It's a different world over there.
No doubt.
I'm sorry. I got us way too far off track.
That's fine.
What else do we want to talk about? Oh, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Okay, because you live in Los Angeles.
Right.
What is this nightmare scene of Kim and Janet, you know, running through these just nightmarish like alleys and warehouses? How do you feel about the depiction of your fair city the show so far?
I mean, I think this third episode really took its sort of view of LA in an entirely different direction. It actually begins like when Jack is talking on the phone with Alan York and he says it's a pretty rough neighborhood out there.
Yeah.
like this is helpfully accentuated by the creative team by having a guy drive through with a van and throwing a beer bottle.
Oh yeah. I forgot about that. That just happens all the time.
Well, like it's Van Nuys and like that's like the valley, so it's like it's LA, but it's like not quite LA, and like there's a strange, like, I don't know why they just interjected that, like, other than to just give a sense of the city. And then like LA has a lot of warehouses, and that's certainly something that's true, but like it's this strange, like, I think that it's more just that it says, oh, it's welcome to the neighborhood, it's all like this, and like, and that's North Hollywood, and like North Hollywood's I've been there, like, it's fine. I haven't really been in the dark warehouses there. Actually, don't know if they're warehouses.
So you haven't been to the warehouse district next to the small municipal airport, is what you're saying?
No, I haven't. I actually don't know where that airport is specifically. Pacoima?
Yeah, that's what it says on the IMDb trivia page.
Okay, that is still the valley.
Okay,
so I guess it is close, if not that close, to where North Hollywood would be. But like North Hollywood is pretty much a city, so it's I mean, it's just that entire sequence is just so strange. It's just depicting LA, or at least a specific part of LA, as this sort of nightmarish place. And we have to talk about the scene in the parking garage.
Oh, yeah, the scene in the parking garage, too. Yeah, that was another, you know, well, and, you know, Dennis Haysbert pulls into this parking garage that's only filled with cars from the 1970s for some reason. You know, it's almost like he is in like a 70s paranoid thriller.
Yeah.
And Kim is running through, not quite like a David Lynch film, because it's not Lynchian. It's not.
Oh, I feel like it's more like Strange Days. So like,
yeah,
like the sort of LA in Catherine Bigelow's film, which I love, but like it's like that's very much a totally decaying city sort of thing.
But it's almost too absurd, like, because it's operating on this soap opera logic, right, where it's like one thing after, it's like they get themselves into a worse and worse fix
right
each time. And then Janet gets hit by the car. It's just like lying in the street. I will say, pretty good, I will say, I think maybe the best ending of an episode so far is episode 3 when she just like opens her eyes. That was pretty good, honestly.
I feel like that's just like vintage 24. Is that sort of like a reversal of a reversal?
Yep.
Like sort of like making a situation like slightly more complicated or better. Like that's just vintage 24.
Yeah, and then the whole next episode, Kim will just not shut up about how they have to go back for Janet. And you're like, no, shut up. Your friend is going to make it. Like, you're selling him out.
Yeah, that sort of dramatic irony is definitely something that we'll be talking about a ton.
Yeah.
But back to the parking garage scene. I mean, it's the deep throat scenes in All the President's Men, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's just like in this very like sort of flat fluorescent lighting. Like it's, you know, like and he just, the guy just walks up to him, Carl Webb. It's like he just walks up to Dennis Haysbert and they're just talking in the middle of the parking garage.
Yeah. Well, and you know, like there's a couple things going on there. One is like, we don't really know why he's there yet, right? So there's this ambiguity around, like, you know, what is this big scandal that's going to break out? You know, is he having an affair or like what murky thing in his past is coming back to haunt him, right? So there's like and Dennis Haysbert, I think, does this great kind of like silent menacing that they're starting to like. He's finally, I think this is the first episode where he gets to stretch a little bit, and then and then he like catches the guy swings the bat at him and he just catches it. And then he like gives, I mean, look, he gives an Obama speech to the guy.
I was actually going to say that. Like, it's like, I obviously, like when Obama was like really making his big push, 24 comparisons were being made.
Yeah.
But like, it's an Obama speech.
I couldn't believe it. My jaw was on the ground.
Yeah.
I mean, really, even like, I want to know if at some point Barack Obama watched this show and was like, I'm going to be president. I'm going to be President Palmer. We got to get him on the pod and ask him.
Yeah. I mean, I think that he does love the show also. Like, The Wire is his preferred choice, but like I'm certain that he loves the show as well. But yeah, like it's like this sort of like very much centrist sort of like, what will you do for yourself, that sort of thing. Like it's just like it is just like very, I mean, it's obviously like what someone running in this sort of Democrat climate would say, but like it's just still like very, the show like seems to take his side to a large degree.
Yeah, you know, something that I know we talked about when we were thinking about doing this is like the politics of the show, which have been characterized as reactionary, and which in a lot of ways they definitely are, and certainly were taken up, you know, most infamously by, you know, Antonin Scalia essentially using the fictional character of Jack Bauer to justify torture, right?
Right.
But I do think that one of the things I'm noticing so far is that it really expresses that politics in America is, like the politics of the show are capital L liberal politics, you know, in the more expansive kind of classical or European sense, right? In that, and I think that, you know, maybe to get back to something we talked a little bit about earlier, I think the example of the two cops is a great, where it's like, it's trying to have its cake and eat it too, because on the one hand, you've got a cop who is like a Barney Fife and pulls someone over for speeding and is a real jag about it, right? And we as the viewer know that these people actually are like in a dire situation and need to speed, need to do this. But of course the guy is just on his high horse, just on a power trip, right? And, you know, so in that scene we get kind of a negative depiction in a way, because it's this guy's just like hoarding all this power and just lording it over whoever at 2 a.m. You know, he got stuck with the night shift. He's not happy about it. But then we get kind of this like noble, like sacrificial cop that, you know, helps Jack Bauer, is a very different depiction of the police, right? Because it's a very much like, things are complex and, you know, people are lots of different ways. And, it strikes me that even though the creators of the show definitely have a reputation for being, you know, further to the right, the complications of a big endeavor like this is that it makes it hard to just do your politics. And so it ends up being this kind of like, sort of like all over the place thing that kind of reverts to the mean, I think, more often than it doesn't. Of course, in later seasons, you know, there's other stuff that I'm sure will come up. But for now, anyways, I'm finding it interesting how it's handling stuff like that.
Yeah, and we have to say that the second cop is a black woman. And
yeah,
the, and,
yeah.
And she dies just at the end of the episode. Like,
it's, yeah, it's, of course.
I won't say that it would necessarily turn out differently. Like, if it was being partnered with a white cop, I think that they were like a certain sacrifice that I feel like that they felt would be more impactful in a certain way, like with having her die.
And of course, this sequence comes after the speeding cop, right? Like,
right.
This sequence come in some ways like arrives so that we have like this noble sacrifice that happens, right? Where this person's just trying to help out Jack Bauer, right? And ends up in a situation that, you know, in some sense it's nobody's fault. You know, they were doing their job. She was doing her job. And yeah, I did find that interesting. And I mean, that kind of goes to the fact that there's been a lot of violence in this show already. Perhaps as is to be expected, most of it has been meted out on female characters and in particular female characters that don't have any other role other than to show up and die.
Right. I mean, like that's like Janet's whole thing is very much in that vein, like this sort of like, I mean, you know, Kim to some extent because she is under this constant peril, but I feel like Janet especially, like having her arm broken, getting roofied, and in this episode, in the third episode, this extraordinary scene of her being injected with heroin.
Man, it's tricky, just like, song. Yeah, just like cooking it up on screen. And man, you know, to go back to what we talked about the last episode, like, it really does, like, this whole sequence is like, man, this is like a suburban squares nightmare of what their kids get up to after dark. Like, started off, you know, drinking beers, smoking reefer, and now they're shooting up heroin because their arm's broken. It really accelerated quickly. But also, you know, unlike Kim, who I think we can say at this point, like, there's some dimension to her character, and you know, she's... I think she's partially defined by the fact that she is such an integral, you know, integrally connected to, you know, the main character here. Like, I don't know that her character is multidimensional yet, but we at least get the scene of her sneaking out of the house and the domestic situation, right, and all of that. And yeah, Janet is just totally flat, you know?
Yeah.
Which I think the show will use a lot, right? Particularly as the bodies stack up. I think we just get a lot of people that show up and then go away very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's a certain element where it just feels like there's characters who just like fulfill one role and then are dispatched. I actually think that the police officer, Jesse Hampton, she actually has a sort of like, she's actually fleshed out pretty well in the small time she has, but
yeah,
there's a certain, but like with her death, like it just feels like very pat and very like, just like, I wouldn't say anticlimactic, but like there's a certain,
it feels
like,
cheap.
Yeah, cheap. Cheap is the right way of putting it. Like,
you get all these, you know, and of course the cops are going to take this guy into custody, and that makes a barrier for Jack Bauer to figure out what's going on. And you have all these cops standing around, you know, honoring their fallen comrade and stuff. It felt very much like a cheap way to complicate the logistics of the plot.
Right. I do like that there's the brief snatches of Spanish that they're saying to each other.
Yeah.
Like, I do love that. Like that's always something that fascinates me, is when you have characters just like reveal something just right off the bat.
Yeah, and I want to read the IMDb trivia item relating to that.
Oh, no.
Because it's very funny. So that's in the fourth episode. The IMDb trivia for this round of episodes, not as interesting, but so this is in the trivia under spoilers. It's called a spoiler. It says the word asshole is actually used in this episode when Jack tries to save the female police officer Jesse Hampton that is being held hostage and attempts to speak Spanish to her. The guy holding her at gunpoint shouts to Jack, quote, "Speak English, asshole." I'm not sure why that's notable trivia or why it's a spoiler. I mean, unless, because I don't even think it doesn't even give away her death. So
yeah.
I don't know exactly what's going on there. Maybe the spoiler is that Jack Bauer knows Spanish.
it's a worthy thing to know. But speaking of swearing, this is the first time that Jack says, "Damn it."
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, like when it first happened, like I think Terry's the one that says it in the pilot.
Yeah, yeah.
So like, I was just waiting for it just all this time, and I think I did like a fist pump when it happened here.
Yes, yeah.
Just, like,
yeah.
I'm just like running around the warehouse.
It was beautiful. apparently, something I read recently, I don't know if it was an interview with him or more IMDb trivia, I don't remember, but apparently at some point he sort of caught on that college students had made a drinking game of it, and there's one episode at some point where he says like 19 or 20 damn it, specifically because he knew that these college kids were doing it, and he was doing it to screw with them. So we'll have to keep an eye out for that one. I think it's, you know, much later in the show, but I mean, I thought that was funny.
There is definitely a chart on Wiki24, and there is at least there's a few times where he says it four times, but I mean we'll see.
Yeah, maybe you know, this is the thing too, around TV shows like this, which just don't, for some reason, like don't quite have the cultural history built up around them. You know, it's like I'm finding all these squirrely articles that are like listicles from sites I've never heard of. That are probably written by robots, but I'm gonna take them all to be absolutely true until proven otherwise. That's why I'm watching this whole show, so I can go and correct those robot articles.
Precisely. Something that I didn't like that doesn't quite work for me. I mean, obviously there's plenty in these episodes that doesn't quite work for me. But like one part that specifically was just like how vehement Nina is about like being mad that Jack thought she was a mole. Like obviously we have a certain. Yeah. Access to his perspective and like his sort of fears that there is a mole, which are obviously true throughout this process, but like, there's something just so such a turn of the dime that like then gets turned back in the next time they talk that doesn't quite go through.
Yeah, you know, something I was thinking about that, because of course like I did remember that Nina ultimately is the mole, and in with that in mind, in retrospect, it does feel like a strategic move on her part to act more wounded than maybe reasonably she should be, right? Because of the, you know, the history of entanglement between her and Jack, that maybe, you know, in a calculating way, she knows that this is in some ways a less suspicious reaction than, you know, being like, hey, I understand why, blah, 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 that you would think this, but it's not me, you know. I suppose in some ways I kind of like rationalize that knowing what comes next, but definitely in the moment I felt like this seems like they're playing it sort of weird. Something about it doesn't quite connect. Like it's one of those moments where the show needs to keep up this high emotional intensity, and you know, it starts to default to that sometimes in places where maybe it doesn't call for that as much. But like the resolution then would have been anticlimactic in a way, like confronts Nina and she's like, hey, I wasn't here then, you know, it couldn't have been me, someone setting me up. That's not as exciting, I guess. But
yeah,
but I agree with you mostly in that it landed sort of weird.
Right. I do also like the continuing regional specificity of them spending the weekend in Santa Barbara together. Like, yeah. In the second weekend of January. Like it's winter time. I mean, obviously the winters aren't nearly as heavy.
Yeah.
In SoCal, but like there's a certain, like I don't know why exactly they went to Santa Barbara. Like, were they just at the beach? Can we see that day?
Yeah, you know, and then, you know, this calls up all kinds of, like, did they do that because, like, was Jack still living with his wife at the time? Was he kicked out at that time? Was this, like, a thing where he had to, like, go away on business or whatever?
And, right. Yeah, I guess that the timeline is a little bit too, is a little bit floaty, in which, like, we don't exactly know how long he and Terry were separated for and, like, what that was like. Because that was a long, because this is... actually, when is Super Tuesday again?
Yeah, it's in the spring sometime.
Okay. Yeah. Well, not that long then. I was conflating the dates. Also, speaking of relationships, something that I remembered again was that like it's always strange seeing George Mason and Nina interact on screen because Xander Berkeley and Sarah Clark met on 24 and then married afterwards.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, you didn't? Oh,
no.
Wow.
That's a much better piece of trivia than what the IMDb page usually turns out.
Yeah, and obviously I think they had a few scenes in the first two episodes, but I think like there's this extended like half an hour in real time conversation that.
Yeah, they've got a great back and forth in this.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
It's a very good scene. Like that sort of Xander Berkeley is always an actor like scene.
Yeah,
like just in various roles, especially in Heat, obviously. But like this, he has this very good sort of weirdly, vaguely sinister or shady sort of way about him that he uses in the interrogation scenes very well.
Yeah, I thought that was good, the kind of almost like snarky attitude she's taking with him, because she knows it'll be the thing that annoys him the most.
You know?
I thought that was pretty good. I also want to say, because we haven't mentioned it, but we do have a change of director in these episodes.
Yeah.
And what reminded me of it is that Stephen Hopkins directs episode 3, and there's a great shot, reverse shot, split screen between Nina and Jack when they're in his office.
Yeah.
That is sort of like, it's positioned, I think, with another shot. I don't remember if it's of like if it's of Kim or Terry or whoever, but I think it's from that. I guess we could call it maybe the B plot.
Right.
And up in the top of the screen, you have this great shot, reverse shot of Jack and Nina having, you know, a kind of intense confrontation about this whole mole business. And I thought it was very well done. And then, of course, in the following episode, which is directed by Vinrik Kolba, who is kind of a consummate TV director. He's done a ton of Star Trek and stuff like that. He's done some great episodes of DS9 and stuff like that, but really just directs it like a TV episode. The split screen really does not do anything in episode 4. It's like he uses it for transitions, and that's about it. It's not, the visual language of the show is still there, but it's obviously you can sort of see the change of hands taking place. And still, you know, still well shot, you know, because he knows what he's doing, knows his way around a TV set, but on a formal level, just not doing as much as the Hopkins episodes.
Wow, he did all good things.
Yeah. He also did the DS9 episode that's like the Bond knockoff when they're in the
time.
Fun stuff. Like, he knows he's not a bad director, but I think he's definitely like
Armand Bashir.
Yeah, he definitely shot it like a straightforward TV episode, and then I wonder even if it was, you know, in the editing room that any of the split screen stuff was done, because it just doesn't seem to take up as much space in the visual language.
Yeah, I agree with that. Speaking of visual language, there's a tidbit in Wiki24 that says, like, regarding like the scene where Jack comes back to CTU and he's like talking with Jamie, like, while trying to ascertain where Nina is, like asking her to pull the files off, just to check whether the card was actually from her computer or not. And it says, the extended scene where Jack Bauer re-enters CTU, sends Nina to his office, talks with Jamie and Tony, then walks upstairs to keep Nina occupied, was envisioned by Stephen Hopkins as one uninterrupted shot. This sequence took about 6 hours, or half of one shooting day, just to block, leading the producers to grow concerned. Hopkins reassured them that it would work. 2 hours later, the scene was wrapped, using only 2 cutaways in total. Kiefer Sutherland described the experience of filming the scene as much like doing live theater. And like in the actual episode, it's just like cut up, just like normal. Like it's just like, you know, like I went back to look, because like how did, like, I don't know exactly how they shot, like, if they not only like cut between like close-ups and things like that, but like if they took out entire sections like of that shot, or, like, reshot it later, because like especially when he's talking to Tony, like it doesn't look like it came from an uninterrupted shot. Like
I'm gonna have to go back and watch it now. Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, that scene has some things going for it. It's got it's got some great drama going on. You know, he's kind of always looking over her shoulder down at Jamie. But I definitely didn't. I wasn't, not knowing that, I wasn't specifically paying attention to that element. Man, it would be, such a bummer. You know, imagine working on that, doing that whole thing, sweating it all day, and then you just like cut it up like any other scene.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of blocking was actually from the like the extras and like other CTU workers. Like, there's you know, like just the time when people get up and like are walking across. So I could see it in terms of that, but like it's like maybe this is like the Magnificent Ambersons like shot like through that was supposed to be like 10 minutes long that was cut down to and like through the party.
Yeah, you know, this like show does have a lot of parallels to early Orson Welles.
Another tidbit that in terms of like the next entry down is mentioning that that Janet's costume was poorly suited for like the stunt of her getting hit by the car. So as a solution, a scene was added where Kim takes a jacket from her purse and puts it around Janet so that they could put pads in when she gets hit. And so apparently that led to the practice of giving characters magic bags so that when characters just have to take out a phone or a gun, they can just have something to take it out.
They always have it. Yeah, you don't have to show them actually getting the thing.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, because she's in, like, it's like some kind of hoodie or something, right, that she ends up mm-hmm. in.
Was that the same enemy of the state satellite
in like when Jack almost is... certainly. Yeah, they're going to reuse that same shot probably until, you know, they get another one from the studio in a couple years. Yeah. And that shot will be good for a while. I do want to also give a shout out because we do finally find out, you know, who Dennis Haysbert is meeting with. The actor, I'm going to, Zach Grenier, I think is how mm-hmm. you pronounce his yeah. name, really brings it. I mean, he's in yeah. that short scene, but like, yeah, I mean, this is where I think the show really thrives, is on these edges where you have these actors that get to come in and just like do a scene and just, right. you know, take advantage of it. This is true of like George Mason as well, right? Whenever his character shows up, he's like, he's a big presence and he gets mm-hmm. to, like, no one's quite chewing the scenery yet. That'll be the case, I know, eventually in the show. But you're getting these bits where actors are really taking advantage of the fact that I get one scene where I'm not just like in the car on the phone, and I'm gonna bring my A game for that scene, you know. And he just like he's just this great presence that kind of balances Haysbert's sort of like Boy Scout thing, and mm-hmm. I thought it was a really great exchange.
Yeah, there's like a. Like this sort of furtive exchange that like in a moral gray zone area, I feel like that's something that 24 generally, like when it's not being undone by silly writing, I think it can do very well. I yeah. think like that, like a lot of it's like with the actors, like just having the right person to play someone not quite sleazy, but like sort of like willing or like, you know, amoral or something like that, just willing to do what's not
yeah,
like something outside of the law. Like I read that apparently in the first in the pilot they literally didn't know what Palmer was going out for, like what he was being called about. So like I mean, this is a like it's an interesting dilemma that they put in,
and I love how much they're making it up as they go along. I respect that.
Yeah, I mean like the dilemma, you know, once again involves violence to a woman.
Yeah,
like it's his. I don't think we necessarily talk much more about, or like, I don't think they've quite elucidated like what happens yet. But like, you know, it's definitely once again, that sort of vein.
Yeah. You know, they're going to keep going back to that. Well, yeah. The whole time it's, and it's already kind of tiresome. So I'm looking forward to the moments where they don't do that. But you know, I think it's one of those things. And this is again where like the show's not even so much its politics as much as like its ideology, right? It doesn't really strain against it in a lot of ways. It kind of just allows the easy thing to be the easy thing,
right?
Particularly in the girlfriend of our evil assassin. Yeah, Mandy. Mandy's girlfriend gets got. Oh, yeah,
Bridget.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, when you said bring it, like, I actually did think of her character. I think, like, that the scenes between her and Mandy, like, are just, like, very, like, surprisingly very, like, strong. Like, you get a good sense of, the sort of struggle, like, the sort of heightened situation that they're in. I think in that situation, like, it makes a little bit more sense because they're deliberately dealing with the quote-unquote bad guys.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Obviously, like, still it's, like, very abrupt and very final.
Yeah, well, you know, and in particular, it's, like, the relationship of Mandy and Bridget is sort of ambiguous until the episode where she dies, right? which, you know, one can't help but read that a certain way. At the same time, though, I think that it does one thing interesting, which is that, man, Mandy is just stone cold, right? Like,
right.
That's like a pretty brutal, like the aftermath of that scene is pretty mm-hmm. brutal. And I think is... Right now, I think that plot has sort of the hardest time kind of gaining some momentum here in the early days. You know, mm-hmm. obviously, like, the plane stuff in the first couple episodes is a big deal. But, like, we don't really have a real connection to these characters because we only know them through kind of their roles as, like, the bad guys, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, the most charitable reading I can give is that despite, you know, the character Bridget being totally instrumental to the plot, you know, and just like a tool that they're using for a certain end, they at least get something interesting out of it as far as the character of Mandy goes. Mm-hmm. which is really, you know, giving us a sense of what she is about. But still, I was just like, man, another one already?
Yeah, I do see the Officer Hampton in the same sort of vein. Slightly different circumstances, but still, like, there's, like, in the span of two episodes, there's two women who are, like sort of built up, you know, to a modest extent, but, like, there's still, like, a genuine interest there, and then they get killed. Like, it's just, like, this, it's very, I think that, you know, like, with someone like the guy who's working on the card, but initially, like, because he's just, like, there, and then he dies, it doesn't really register in that same way, and, like, it's actually more, like, people talking about him after the fact that you get more sense of him.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's, like, you get, there's a sense that, like, you spend more time with these sort of sacrificial characters and sacrificial women in a weird way.
Yeah, well, and it's a little bit different from, say, someone like Walsh, who I think is meant in some sense, like, to, you know, he's the boss, right?
Right.
And you know, he's the person that gives Jack this information and is like, hey, we got to figure this out. So in some sense, you know, I think his death is kind of an early version of the big, you know, shocking deaths that something like Game of Thrones would become really well known for, right? Like, I think it's an early precursor to that kind of attitude, you know, happens very early in the show. But yeah, you know, he at least gets, like, some time and is important, like, sets the whole plot in motion, basically, of at least the mole plot, right? Whereas, yeah, I mean, and, you know, this is a show where, you know, tertiary characters will come and go, like, at a head-spinning rate. So it's interesting to notice the patterns of who those people are, but also, you know, within the context of the show where I would assume there are hundreds of such cases, you know, the show has a pretty laissez-faire attitude toward life and death for basically everybody except Jack Bauer.
I mean, there's also the Hoyt wasn't quite certain about, like, but the wiki, like, says that he's a male prostitute, is like the guy who Kim and Janet run into, his, like, sudden exit also, like, when he's like, he for some reason, like, Kim, like, converts him, or like he causes,
yeah, he helps him out, like, whack that guy over the head,
yeah, and then he, like, is just, the last you see of him is just him just getting beaten by that guy.
I didn't get a sense that he was, like, a sex worker or anything.
Well, like, there's that guy that's sort of, like, that's, like, walking away, and, like, it looked like he was, like, crouched in front of him or something like that, but it seemed a little bit too, like, a bit fuzzy from myself, especially because he's talking about, like, if they want to score some dope or something like that. I think that chase, like, through the that chase in episode 3 as opposed to the chase in episode 4 through warehouses, there's a lot of warehouses. I mean, it's true, there's Ellie has plenty of warehouses.
I mean, it's a pretty in fairness, it's a dynamic space to have something like a gunfight.
I think so. And, like, the chase, like, with them, like, looking while they're hiding from, like, one of the guys, and they're, like, looking back and forth, and, like, the camera's panning back and forth, like, that's done pretty well. Like, there's a certain there's a good tension to that. Thankfully, there's not a jump scare, but it's
The whole, you know, the sequence begins to strain a little bit when it just feels like, you know, a kind of continual out of the frying pan into the fire. But but I do think, you know, there's maybe something in that absurdity that is, like, at the heart of the show, right? Which is, I think I joked with you that it's like a workplace comedy without jokes, but it's also like a soap opera, in a very real way. With, you know, with the constraint of the real time thing. But, like, in order to keep things going, like, there always has to be one next thing. And this is true of any show, but when it's put into this box of this is happening literally, you know, 1 hour later, you know, and I mean, on the like very macro level, the fact that there's what, like, 8-9 seasons of the show, I guess if you count the revival series as a 9th season, like, you know, this guy, 9 days, you know, the 9 circles of hell where he has the worst day anybody could possibly have. Yeah, at a certain point, the conceit itself is, like, you know, when repeated, is sort of ridiculous on its face, and you just kind of have to buy in, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that that's true on the micro level of the show, where it's like, yeah, okay, like on the one hand, this is all a little bit ridiculous and sensational, but like that's the kind of show it is. Like it's if you're complaining about it, you're just watching the wrong kind of show. Like
yeah.
it couldn't really be any other kind of show.
Right. I think it's less that I complain about the danger specifically, but it's like more like how they sort of like they attempt to flesh it out, like with like her trying to talk about, I don't know, human decency or something like that. Like it just feels like I don't know, like I live in LA, and like I think that if I ask someone and they said no, then I just like go away. You know, like it just like doesn't seem like the kind of situation you want to keep yourself in.
Yeah, and also, you know, again though, it's like I think it's again a perfect example of the type of liberalism of the show, right?
Yeah.
Which is like all you need to do is like talk to people, you know, you wouldn't. But then at the same time, you know, it also kind of thrives in that sensationalism of, you know, coming up to someone random on the street and asking for their cell phone, instead of maybe getting a rude, like, please go away from me. It ends up being this kind of like, you know, salacious character, right?
Right.
Who is, you know, there's malevolence like lurking around every corner here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some sense that's like the depiction of the city is like there is danger of all kinds everywhere. You know, it is mm-hmm. a very paranoid, it has a very paranoid view of just like living in a space with other people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah, it just feels, episode 3 in particular, it just feels like hyperbolic in that way. Quickly, before we stray too far from it, like you're talking about like the worst day. I mean, obviously, like, I think that was part of like the, like in the trailers, he would say like, and this is like the longest day of my life or something.
Yes,
like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But apparently the wiki on the season 1 page, the opening narration from the original pilot script says 24 hours, one full turn of the earth on its axis. Most days blend into all the others, but some we remember for the rest of our lives. I can't imagine the show opening with that, but
I feel like that was definitely a leftover from their original conception of this show as like a comedy drama leading up, like the day of a wedding. That was the original idea pitched at the infamous IHOP.
Now I do remember that.
Yeah, like the whole idea, like all that remains from that is that narration in the pilot episode that never got into the actual show, and just the conceit of 24 hours itself.
Yeah.
And I kind of, you know, this makes me think, knowing that that was their original conception, I wonder how the show, it sort of bumped up against the Halloween problem. You know, Halloween 3 tried to move toward this anthology model. And I think Halloween 3 is a great movie, but understandably, like, both at the time and today, when people encounter it, they're like, well, where's Michael Myers, you know? And he's nowhere to be found. And I wonder, you know, what if 24 had been this anthology where each season was a totally different type of show with a different tone and a different scenario, right? Like you could, like the conceit is incredibly dynamic and flexible, but of course, they hit on something in this first season and just like stuck with it forever.
Yeah.
Which is fine, you know, but what could
I would have
been?
Loved to see that. I mean, to be fair, I don't know if staying up 24 hours at a wedding is very common, but
I think the idea was like, you know, again, I think the idea still had a little bit of like catastrophism with it,
which
is like, you know, things going wrong, et cetera. I don't know. My guess is that they didn't get very far fleshing that out until they lighted on something else. But you could imagine like any kind of like, you know, any kind of thing. It didn't have to be the show that it ended up being. Like you could do this in a lot of different ways. But yeah, it's interesting to me that they haven't tried to, you know, revive the conceit in a different way. You know, of course they tried to do kind of the series without Jack Bauer, right? And kind of like inject some, you know, a younger feel into it. But but I think the mistake there is, you know, making it the same show basically, except without all the people that you know and love from the show.
I'm very interested in legacy. Like we'll see how we react when we get there, but like just like the idea of it seems wonky in an appealing way.
There is a great line that the cop with the cop that's with Jack asks, CTU, what the hell is that?
Like it's a good question. Like there's a, like, you know, you never really get a sense, at least in the first season, like, you know, by season 7 there's like all the like trial stuff, but how well known is CTU? Like, is it like an actual Like, is it supposed to be something on the level of like a FBI, or is it like, you know, like this sort of deep secret sort of agency?
Yeah, well, and I think you mentioned this, which I did not realize until you mentioned it, is that it's a military organization, right? Technically, yeah. Right? Which is weird because, and perhaps, you know, I think a sign of the changing nature of the military at the time the show was conceived, like, mm-hmm. it's all suits up to the top.
Yeah.
There aren't ranks, you know, but it's interesting that it is like an arm of the military or the Pentagon or however exactly it's situated in the wider bureaucracy. I sort of, in my headcanon, it's, and I think at some point, maybe we'll get fleshed out in the show. My memory is really fuzzy, but I think eventually it's sort of like, it's set up a little bit as a rival to like something like the CIA, right?
Yeah.
I think there's some, maybe to a lesser extent the FBI, but of course, like, counterterrorism is going to have a more global, more global imprimatur than the FBI is supposed to anyways.
I'm looking at like the sort of CTU page on the wiki, and like, it's
like
I can't tell how much of this is like, you know, like at the beginning of the show, how much is it like sort of changed up or reintegrated or something like that later. But apparently it was the Homeland Security intelligence arm, something like that. And it was established after the first World Trade Center bombing.
Okay.
So apparently that did happen. Don't know if that happened in the show proper.
Well, it didn't, because CTU stopped 9/11 from happening.
Yeah. It's like on the, it says 9/11 was a common name for a major terrorist attack by Al Qaeda against a tower complex in the USA.
A tower complex,
according to the second novel in the 24th.
Oh, novel it's in series. The novels. Okay. Yes. Yeah. We'll get there.
Yeah.
We'll get there.
Oh, God.
I will take those on as my personal responsibility to dig into. I feel like if I'm going to find out anything about the way the bureaucracy actually works, it's going to be in the novels. Are they treated as canon?
I don't know how any of that works, there's no like Star Wars level canon.
No one cares canon enough thing. To decide what's
yeah.
canon for this.
Yeah, show. So treating everything both as canon and not as canon.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, but so a tower complex. It's fascinating.
They're just like, what?
Like, they just don't want to bring it in? Or it's like...
Well, this suggests that it could have happened, you know, in another city, right?
Yeah,
because it just says a tower complex
in the U.S., yeah.
In the U.S., huh.
That's so strange. Like, it doesn't even see, it feels like there's a collapse or anything. That is bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely my canon in the show is that, you know, having CTU stops 9/11, and that's... Of course, like, you know, a lot of bad things still happen. You know, you got to break some eggs to make an omelet. But they stopped the big one. They got into George Bush's office before he hit the button to send the missiles. I mean, they got on the plane. They stopped the guys before they got on the plane.
I mean, technically, you could conjecture that the plane that went down in this one was the actual plane and was going to hit like the Fox Plaza building or something.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, in this world, George Bush doesn't even become president, right? So
yeah.
So that's why. That's why it doesn't happen. And you can decide whether that is just, you know, bureaucratic incompetence or malevolence on the part of the deep state. That's up to the listeners. I stay out of such matters. So
we'll be back. No, it's fine. We're going to get on a lot of these tangents. I think even more than we're expecting. But to bring things back a little bit more, speaking of planes, what was Kim's plan when they were gonna run out and they were gonna like almost get hit by the plane?
Yeah,
like
really
it seemed
know.
Like she was like timing it so that the plane would be crossing, but they should just like run too slow, and because there's not really a lot of mass anyways to sort of like, or like it's not like you're gonna run it in front of a train or something.
Yeah, see, I was just gonna say it almost feels like in the script it was supposed to be at a train yard, and they just like couldn't get the location, so they were like, well, we can go to the airport. But that scene just doesn't really have the same effect because, yeah, it's like, okay, that maybe that seems to have delayed Kim and Janet more than it did the two dudes.
Exactly. Like, you're not going to really wave down a plane that's, like, seconds from taking off.
I don't even think that's what she's trying to do. Like, running in front of it. I mean, maybe best case scenario, you know, you don't get hit by the plane, but it's sort of they land and, you know, call the like, you know, air traffic control sees crazy people running across the the tarmac. They'll maybe, you know, do something about it, one would assume. But yeah, I think a lot of it is just, you know, I suppose you could just chalk it up to in the moment. They're just like running. They're just trying to get out of there. And
right.
I don't know that there's anything. I don't know that there's anything more there than just like, hey, we got to like, this scene's got to be X amount of seconds long. So you're going to run in front of this plane and kind of stumble a little bit and then keep going.
Lots of weird decisions. Another very, very weird decision is when they're going back to kill Janet, and like, instead of just running her over or something like that, they like, Dan's just driving at like 3 miles an hour, like slowly getting ready to shoot her. Like, what was his plan?
I forgot about that.
It took like 30 seconds for him to reach her, and like, he's not just gonna, like, it would be much more plausible if he like just says, oh, I didn't see her, and just run her over instead of pulling out a gun in the middle of the street.
I mean, maybe, you know, maybe it's just he knows he needs guarantees.
Yeah, but I feel like
he doesn't seem to have thought that far ahead about anything else, though.
That's true. It's just like, I don't know, I just find they don't seem that impaired, but it's just, I just find the thought of them like running while they're just very high, just like running after them, like trying to chase them.
You know, that's true. That's like, what, you know, I don't know, what are they like, what kind of state are they in right now? They seem to be, you know, fairly on edge, you know, so maybe the weed is just like taking the edge off a little bit.
Yeah, I guess.
But they're obviously, you know, they're cross-faded maybe several ways, given the various paraphernalia that we've seen.
Right.
Yeah, I don't, you know, it's definitely a plot that if you're the bad guy, you're making the classic mistake of just like relying on some burnouts, because, you know, you're treating your sort of like evil plot making as like a McDonald's franchise, where you're just like finding the cheapest labor possible.
I don't know why they just didn't like, you know, duct tape him to begin with. Also,
they're like never tied up or... Another thing is, like, why does it take her so long to, like, run, you know? Like, at some point, they must have been at, like, a stoplight or something.
Yeah,
you know, they've been driving around town. I mean, I guess the advantage is it's in the middle of the night. There's not a lot of traffic or whatever. But...
Right. I also like how the woman that, the homeless woman that that Terry and Alan ask about, like, what happens there. Like, she has, this, like, the, just this incredibly thick Boston accent.
I loved that. I loved that. That's a great choice.
Yeah.
The show is at its best when you have people making choices like that.
Yeah, it's just weird bits of casting.
Yeah.
Also the guy that gets effortlessly punched by Jack.
Oh yeah.
Like SCTO. just him just like punching him in the stomach once and just knocking him out cold.
Yeah, and that's like,
I mean,
such
Jack
a
Bauer
great,
could do that, but still.
That's like such a great little scene there, where he just dupes him. Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Also some incredible, like, I think we're finally getting into the like malevolent Jack faces, like when he's hearing from Jamie that it was Nina's computer, and he's like, has this like incredible glower, and him just shouting at Nina in the conference room / coffee table.
Yeah, that's like, and then when he like slams John Hawks against that, like the container or whatever, and is getting in his face, and we'll see more of that. That's for sure.
Maybe one final scene that I did like was the one where Aaron Pearson and Palmer are talking, and it's just like already, like Glenn Morshauer is just in it. Like he already has that sort of, you know, like calming but also sort of steely focus. Like that's something that, you know, I think is probably why they kept bringing him back, but like, it's always welcome.
Yeah. He's, you know, I think, he walked on that set from that first second, and he knew what he was doing. He knew, he had like a vision for that character.
Yeah, absolutely. You could definitely say that the show is underwritten at times, overwritten at others. But like, there's definitely characters or actors that are able to work with that, especially. I think that honestly, I need Johnson Gerald, who plays Sherry Palmer. Like, I think that she has that also. I think she has something of that.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a Deep Space Nine partisan, so I love seeing her in this. I think she's excellent.
Yeah.
I think you're right, though. I think one of the things that when the show, it's fun to watch when they've really overwritten it and gone a little overboard on someone. But I do think the show oftentimes in its sort of like flat nature, in a way, invites actors to really take control.
Yeah.
Which gives us, I think, some really good scenes and some really interesting performances. I will say that one of the problems with Aaron Pierce for me is that he looks like Mark Broch.
Yes.
That's so I'm a little bit. So I just, you know, it's a great performance, you know. Yeah. The more I watch the show, the more it will just be Aaron Pierce again. But, you know, the period of my life when I watched this show was a long time ago now. And in between, I've definitely seen more of Mark Broch's work than Aaron Pierce. So,
yeah.
But yeah, great character. And, you know, they're really starting to, like, it's an ensemble cast in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. despite, like, you know, Kiefer's central presence.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is, you know, so often, like, in those scenes that he's not in, and he's had a lot of sort of, like, almost solo scenes, you know, going on these chases and going off. Like,
yeah, definitely.
It's really up to the ensemble to carry a lot of mm-hmm. the show.
Yeah. I think that's why, like, Kim sort of, like, becoming more, I don't know, assertive, at least in the third episode. I think the fourth episode is like sort of regresses in some ways, just because it's just not nearly as interesting a situation, but like I think she does like get more into it. I still think that Terry, like, it's just like still too trapped in that sort of situation for her to really do anything.
Yeah, that's another thing, you know, you end up with, as part of the real-time thing, you end up with a lot of places where, you know, they're giving characters busy work basically. That's got to be hard if you're an actor, even if you have kind of a juicier role, which, you know, Terry Bauer is not a juicy role at all. No. But even if you have one of the more fun roles, you know, you do have to have some time where you're just kind of like burning the tires and you don't really have a lot to take advantage of. And that in combination with some of the underwriting is I think one of the things in the first episode that I was feeling is that, you know, these other characters aren't given a lot to do because it really has to establish Jack and some of the other stuff. But yeah, I you know, obviously by the end of the season, you know, Terry Bauer's role throughout all of this becomes clear as mm-hmm. far as like the way, you know, the plot is put together, like the mechanics mm-hmm. of it. But I really just don't recall what she does for the next 20 hours. and my feeling so far is like, not a lot.
Yeah, that's a good question. I can't really recall.
Yeah, so we'll see. And I mean, who knows, maybe there's like some good character work there that I just don't remember. But yeah, I, as of right now, just not a whole lot to do.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh yeah, okay, so we did get so in episode 3 in the I believe this is the intense scene where he's kind of interrogating Nina. Mm-hmm. We do get the classic, who are you working for? I was really hyped about that. Oh, there's a great line read from Kiefer Sutherland when Terry calls Jack and is with Alan, and he's like, no, you need to stay at the place, wait for him, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
That's real snotty. He says it real snotty. He's like, why don't you put Alan on the phone?
Yeah.
I loved that line read.
Like, I part of me did think, like, whether he thought there was a chance that she was having an affair.
Well, you know, I think that that's kind of like, I think there's an insecurity in their relationship. And
yeah, definitely.
I think to some degree, this is maybe the writers trying to balance it out a little bit, because mm-hmm. we know that Jack hasn't been faithful.
Yeah.
But we don't know anything about Terry. She's nothing. So true. I do think that there's some intimations, and they're doing this almost exclusively through Jack's own kind of like attitude toward this guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's some intimations that, you know, maybe, and I feel like it's all projection, you know. I mean, I don't know at what level the writers or the showrunners thought this through, but just taking it as a text and just trying to read it, mm-hmm. I do feel like Jack is completely projecting, because I sort of wonder whether or not his own affair is known by his wife, or whether it's just kind of assumed, right? I get the sense that she doesn't know who, but that something did happen. I think that sort of seems clear in the exchange between her and Nina in, I don't know, episode two or something when she calls.
Right.
So I don't think she knows. Jack knows that she doesn't know, but yeah, so that feels like projection. Then again, I don't know that they aren't going to build that up into something or not. The last little line I have, George Mason says, and just beautiful line delivery and also just like great, great tagline for our show. What's so special about Jack Bauer?
Precisely.
That's what we're here to find out.
And I hope that you'll continue to join us on our onward march.
Yeah, like, subscribe, etc.
Yes, please engage in whatever way you choose to.
Yeah, see you on the other side.